This is Dr. Richard Barone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Andy Roy. Today is August 28, 2003. It's approximately 8:40 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas again, and Mr. Roy, you're in Jaffrey, New Hampshire.
Yeah.
Let's continue, sir, with talking about your post-Vietnam experience. And before we move permanently to discussing that, let me ask you a couple of general questions about your three tours. When you think back, do you remember any do any brave incidents, incidents of bravery, come up in your mind that stand out?
Yes, there were certain leaders that fulfilled the American military concept of leadership, which is basically the term "follow me."
Mm-hmm.
It takes an awful lot of courage and guts to be the first one to stand up, to yell "follow me," and to lead everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
There were also men who were not leaders but who did the same thing, you know, became leaders.
Mm-hmm.
Those kind of things. Like I said, it takes an awful lot of courage. I would say the most times that I saw an awful lot of courage was when I was a door gunner.
Mm-hmm.
Helicopters would generally do anything to get in to the troops, to deliver ammunition, to pick up the wounded, to deliver reinforcements under when the troops on the ground were under tremendous pressure, you know, surrounded, outnumbered, outgunned, and I just saw time and time and time again where the aircraft commander made the decision, yes, we're going in.
Mm-hmm.
A helicopter is very vulnerable, especially when it comes in because it's going slower, and especially when it hovers or lands. It's just so vulnerable. The other three men in the crew are pulled along, of course, by the aircraft commander's decision. The aircraft commander would pull the rest of us,
mm-hmm.
and generally we'd all agree, but it was finally the aircraft commander's decision. And I've seen where that bravery has paid off so many times in saving lives. And I've seen where the bravery ended up killing one or more,
mm-hmm.
or all of the crew. And it's a very terrifying thing to go in on something like that. At least on the ground, you can get your head down.
Yes.
you can't up in the helicopter. The pilot and the co-pilot can't even shoot back. At least the door gunners can shoot back.
Mm-hmm.
It's most often, helicopter crews just went so far out of their way to get in and do what had to be done to help ground crews.
Mm-hmm.
This is why, as a result, infantry and helicopter units thought so highly of each other. This is the reason that I went on my second tour to be a door gunner.
Mm-hmm.
Because those guys were right there with us at all times, and if anything possible in any way to get in to do the things that had to be done in order to save our lives, they did it.
Mm-hmm.
And they picked up our mail for us. The door gunners would take the mail for us. But there was a very, very close kinship. We never knew each other personally, of
mm-hmm.
course, but we had just so much tremendous respect for each other. And as a result, when a helicopter went down, we would go out of our way to get to that helicopter,
mm-hmm.
and rescue anybody, or just to get the bodies alone.
Mm-hmm.
So there was, I would say, the most instances of bravery that I've seen were when I was a door gunner. I have seen instances of bravery also among South Vietnamese troops.
Mm-hmm.
Much generally to our surprise, because especially when I first got over there, the South Vietnamese Army was just starting to really get some experience and some administrative expertise.
Mm-hmm.
but there were times that I saw South Vietnamese that would just hang right in there when they almost didn't have a chance at all.
Mm-hmm.
And especially the Montagnards, the hill people.
Yes.
They were incredibly brave. But any particular, if I were to really, I really couldn't name any one situation right now. Unfortunately, a lot of the times that somebody did something very creative, it never made its way administratively to the point up so that the person received the recognition or the decoration they deserved.
Mm-hmm.
And that's too bad, but it happens. I mean, you've got that chaos that's going on, not just out in the field or on the battlefield, but also in the rear, because they're trying to monitor, you know, the supplies needed, the wounded, the dead, you know, everything that's needed to keep a company or a battalion of infantry functioning. So, you know, sometimes that didn't happen,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately. But I've seen some leaders that I just so highly respected. They did what they had to do, and again, like helicopter crews, sometimes paid the price.
Right.
But it's beaten into American officers and American leadership that the officer goes first,
mm-hmm.
that he leads from the front, and the motto is, follow me.
Mm-hmm. On the flip side of that, do you remember any particularly humorous events that stand out in your mind?
Humorous?
Yes, sir.
Yes, a lot of them were humorous after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many. And some, you've got to understand, were morbid humor.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to understand the situation or the context within which it took place. The people that haven't been in the situation might not even see it as humorous.
Mm-hmm.
But there were a great deal of funny incidents. There were some people who were totally surprised by something that happened and didn't quite know how to react and reacted contrary to what they should have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't cowardice or anything. It was just shock and surprise.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one guy was outside of our position pulling OP, and just as dusk was falling, and all of a sudden around the corner from where he was standing walked two individuals,
mm-hmm.
with weapons, and they were North Vietnamese. Well, they didn't know we were there, and he didn't hear them coming. They walked and just about bumped right into him,
mm-hmm.
and his first statement was, stop. And they looked at him, and they looked at each other, and they turned around and slowly started to walk away, and all he said was, stop, come back here. And they walked a little faster, and they walked a little faster, and he mm-hmm. said, stop. And I can remember hearing him yelling, stop, and then they broke into a run and took off. I mean, there's lots of little incidences like that.
Mm-hmm.
I won't go into the morbid humor kind of thing because, again, you really had to have been in the situation to understand why it was funny.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure that people understand there were situations like that. A lot of them were terrifying at the time, but then when looking back on it later on and the factor of the fear was taken away,
mm-hmm.
then it was humorous.
Right.
There were an awful lot of things. I think we grabbed for anything that was humorous,
mm-hmm.
To replace the fear. I think that's what a lot of bravado was in people, too.
Mm-hmm.
It was false bravado.
How did you deal with the fear? Was it just through finding humor in it, or what else did you do?
There was a lot of false bravado, like
mm-hmm.
I said. That was done, and we made a lot of comments, negative comments about the enemy, and that was done to kind of make yourself feel more superior.
Mm-hmm.
There was and this was against standard operating procedure, against the Geneva Convention, there was some mutilation of bodies.
Mm-hmm.
If you were caught doing it, I mean, you'd be court-martialed for it, or Article 15. There was one instance, I mean, for a period up at Dak To, when the North Vietnamese were shooting prisoners and wounded, that really even the officers backed off. Some people were taking years.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that what that is an attempt to, in your mind, humiliate or degrade your enemy,
mm-hmm.
to make you feel superior or feel better about it. And I think it's totally based in fear. It's not sadism or anything. I think it's totally an attempt to offset your own fear.
Mm-hmm.
Bravado was generally the one thing. You had to feel you were better than the enemy, because once you started feeling the enemy was better than you, then emotionally he's going to gain the initiative.
Mm-hmm.
I don't doubt at all that the other side functioned in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
We concentrated an awful lot on times that the enemy screwed up, or what we used to call half-stepped.
Mm-hmm.
And they did an awful lot. There's this public conception of, the communist soldier, and they usually called them VC, except that most were NBA. Could go through the jungle like a cat, knew the jungle fantastically, was part of the environment, was an expert at this and that. And they weren't at all. They made so many mistakes. At times we couldn't even believe it. And we concentrate on those and talk about those later on.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think that also was an attempt to feel better than the enemy and thus overcome the fear.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there were times when you just couldn't overcome the fear, and all you had to do was grit your teeth and hope for the best.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when the situation got extremely hot, right down to the nitty-gritty, then you wouldn't even think of the fear. I mean, then you just functioned.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you pretty well live for the second at a time like that. And I think in any kind of situation, car accidents, whatever, people revert to that.
Mm-hmm. Did you talk about it with your fellow soldiers? Very much?
Oh, all the time, even today. Again, that concept, that misconception that the communists were 10 feet tall was far from the truth.
Mm-hmm.
They had their problems with certain individuals. Not to say that they were horrible soldiers, especially the North Vietnamese. They were not at all, but they were human. And it was, to us, we would, again, to make ourselves feel more superior, emphasize that internally and externally,
mm-hmm.
to others. And after the war, we've talked about it, too, when I've talked to people, especially over the last 5 or 6 years since the Internet became available to me, and I started meeting these guys again.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, there was a tremendous amount of respect for the North Vietnamese. They were not Iraqi soldiers by any means. They were very, very tough troops. They were very dedicated to their cause.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, a tremendous amount of them came over to our side, primarily because when they found out that they'd been lied to, because they only had one source of information.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, though, they were not 10 feet tall.
Right.
So.
Let's talk about when you were home, after you got home. First of all, were there any incidents at the airports, any problems?
I only remember one outright incident where somebody said something.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a comment in passing. It wasn't a hippie kind of person at all. These two men were older than we were. Looked like business. Weren't wearing business suits, but mm-hmm. we were like business. And then It wasn't so much at the airport as much as when I got home. There were some things at the airport that happened that were very touching.
Such as what?
Well, I remember I was coming home from my, my first tour, I believe, and sitting next to me was a soldier who was coming home on emergency leave, his mother and his sister. They were also from Massachusetts, where I was from at that time,
mm-hmm.
and they'd been killed, his mother and sister had been killed in a car accident. And he had drunk an awful lot before he got on the plane, which affected his motions even more.
Mm-hmm.
And soldiers will take care of each other. He was sitting next to me, so I ended up taking care of him. Then when I found out he was from Massachusetts, which is where I was going,
mm-hmm.
I realized I kind of had to take care of the guy all the way home, you know,
mm-hmm.
even after the plane landed on the West Coast. And we got on regular aircraft to go to our home states or nearby. He and I ended up flying into Boston together. And I had to kind of take care of him in the stopovers at airports and the like.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember stopping at one airport, and I'd seen them before. There were these little centers for soldiers, or I should say for military personnel. And they were run by... There must have been about five or six little old ladies there, grandmotherly type, and they were just so helpful. And you know, they'd walk around looking for a drunk GI.
Mm-hmm.
they'd take them to this place, you know, lay them down, let them get them sleep, make sure that they got to their gate on time for their next flight. I remember taking this, wandering around, and suddenly looking over and seeing one of these places. As soon as they saw me, they came out. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, they took them, and they did what they could to kind of straighten them up and the like. And they gave me a place to sit down. They gave me coffee and cookies and sandwiches and the like. And,
mm-hmm.
and I thought it was very touching. And I saw these places almost all the time at the large airports.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a time... I don't know if I related it. I was going over on my third tour. I was in Seattle, and I was with three or four other guys that I had met up with, and we went into sort of like a lounge, and I didn't know it at the time. I mean, I was 20. I didn't know it at the time, but in Washington State,
mm-hmm.
The drinking age is 21, and we all ordered a drink, ordered a rum and Coke, and the waitress took the order, and next thing I know, there was a policeman tapping me on the shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And asking me for ID. And I showed it to him, and he saw I was 20, and he was extremely apologetic. He really was.
Mm-hmm.
He said, but, you know, that's the age here. The only thing that annoyed me was that the waitress didn't card me and say, I'm sorry.
Right.
Go and get a police officer.
Right.
And the other guys got a little indignant, but I just said, you know, that they were 21 or old, and I said, don't worry about it. I'll wait for you guys outside.
Mm-hmm.
I did see some anti-war posters or signs or something. I don't remember the exact thing, but I didn't personally run into too much.
Okay.
It was after I got home, and I was watching the news and the newspapers, and nobody really, I mean, I came back from just a tremendous experience, and nobody wanted to hear it.
Mm-hmm. And then family members, friends didn't ask you?
Well, family members did. Immediate family. The rest, they listened at first, but then they really didn't want to talk about it.
Did you want to talk about it? Did you have a need to talk about
Jesus, it? Jesus, I had a tremendous need to talk about it. And I didn't know anybody else who had, you know, been over there. I ended up meeting one or two guys, and it really hit home when I started school, and that's where I ran into my big problems.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember how I let it be known that, you know, I'd just come back a few months earlier, and that's when I ran up against that loud minority, and more disturbingly, the silent majority.
Mm-hmm. This is the summer of 1969, and this is the fall when you started school?
The fall of the next year.
Okay.
I picked up that, you know, nobody wants to talk about this unless it was somebody that was there. I had met one guy, I guess, about 4 months after I got back. I ended up going into the hospital with malaria, malaria relapse. And then the next fall, I began school, and that's when I really, really just ran smack into it. I'd seen the demonstrations. I didn't let them bother me at all. But it wasn't until I got to school and people were coming out with the accusations. You know, like I said, at the time, the My Lai affair had broken. And generally, this was everybody, not everybody, but the silent, the loud minority's view of this is what American soldiers were like. And I can remember being confronted on it and trying to explain, no, that was not standard operating procedure in any way, shape, or form. I tried to explain them, you know, would you go off and do something like that? That it was only a few members of that unit that did it. And, you know, the reaction was generally, well, the military makes a robot out of you, and, you know, they don't. Not unless you're part of a Nazi kind of government or, you know, something like that. There was no listening. There was a lot of shouting down.
Where did this happen? Was this on campus to a group or individuals would approach you?
On campus. And even after I learned, don't say any more about it, it just kept up. I did meet two guys who took me aside and said, you know, hey, we're Vietnam vets too. You kind of screwed up coming out with that. I mean, they said, it's not your fault. You didn't know how, but they'd been going to school for a year or so. And they said, man, you've got to try and be quiet about this. Get through this semester, and when you start your next classes, hopefully you'll just fade in. And it upset me because, you know, I hadn't done anything wrong. The accusations were just... And it got to the point there was just constant comments as I passed people in the hall, and then it got to the point where my books were being stolen. And I just threw up my hands and left. Very disgusted, very angry, getting angrier constantly. And then when I watched the American government betray South Vietnam by not giving them the supplies, the beans, the bullets, the spare parts, the fuel, and everything like we had promised, while the North Vietnamese went off and blatantly broke the treaty, I got, and still am, very bitter about the whole thing.
You're talking about when the United States pulled out 73 and then the intervening year and a half?
Right, between there and 75, we had promised to keep the South Vietnamese supplied with ammunition, spare parts, and fuel, and we didn't. We just got it done.
Did you keep up with the war effort once you
were home? Oh, yes.
What did you think about the media coverage?
I was very upset by it. It was just so blatant. It was always negative. Something positive would happen. They'd give a little paragraph on it, but then the next paragraph would be, but, and then something negative would be thrown into it. And the more and more that American troops were pulled out, and especially finally after they're all pulled out, the media tended to concentrate more on the political front, Nixon, actually. And it's like what happened to the South Vietnamese and the Cambodians and the Laos wasn't really of any great deal of interest. Cambodia did become later on, but as one North Vietnamese said, it's really good what happened in Cambodia because it kept the light off what was going on in South Vietnam, which was pretty bad. The one time it came back into the spotlight, of course, was the final days with the helicopter leaving off the embassy roof.
Yes.
And I remember going to work that morning. I picked up the paper. The picture was there. I still have the newspaper, I think. I was just depressed all day long at work, thinking how the whole thing I was just disgusted, completely disgusted.
I take it that the rhetoric at the time that the United States achieved peace with honor, you didn't buy into that?
That was peace with dishonor, to me. Us and the South Vietnamese were winning militarily, but we lost at the negotiating table, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We should have learned from the Korean War. This negotiation kind of thing really leads nowhere. I mean, the enemy will negotiate for the next 100 years, but keep what they've already taken and proceed to take more.
Mm-hmm.
Nixon, of course, did get tough. One of the few things I approved of Nixon. And it proved that the North Vietnamese understood that language, because all of a sudden after the Christmas bombings,
mm-hmm.
We employed B-52s. And contrary to what a lot of people think, we didn't bomb civilian areas and the like intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
We just hit targets we should have hit earlier. All of a sudden, the North Vietnamese are ready to talk. And that should have said so much, just books worth of how to deal with those people. But everybody just wanted out, I guess.
What can you say overall about American policy in general?
Well, ever since Korea, we seemed to, this is up until recently,
mm-hmm.
We've been so concerned about negotiating, about how we're seen. A lot of people in this country see us as overly aggressive, and I don't think that's been true until recently. Some people just believe you can negotiate things with anybody, that you could have negotiated Hitler out of the Second World War, which of course was tried and
mm-hmm.
didn't accomplish anything. Some people you just can't negotiate with. And I think a lot of people don't understand that really the world is kind of like your personal life, except in macrocosm.
Mm-hmm.
You have crime around here, back in civilian life. You're going to have crime on a world basis, too. And you're not going to negotiate with a murderer or a confirmed drug dealer or a rapist or anything like that. You're not going to negotiate with certain governments. But people don't see it that way. A lot of people like to live idealistically.
Mm-hmm.
I want to avoid conflict and war after seeing what it does. But there are certain times where I believe you've got to finally say, okay, this is the way it's going to be. This is the way it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's not talking about recent happenings in the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
I'm willing to fight, but only if it's a last step. And we've really practically tried anything, everything else. Because once you've ever been to a war and seen the destruction and the death and how the civilian population gets caught in the middle, I don't think anybody who rationally thinks about it wants to see it happen again.
Do you think the United States learned lessons from the Vietnam War experience?
Not a single one.
Okay.
Nothing.
Can you expand on that?
I think we continue to do some of the same things. I think the recent happenings in Iraq have showed a lack of planning and a goal, a lack of consideration even for what happens after the war. We didn't have that issue with Vietnam, of course. But I think that it just wasn't a lot of planning. Was played as we go along.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't see an awful lot of lessons have been learned and remembered.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we'll continue to make the same mistakes over and over. To me, it's interesting that, with the exception of the Secretary of State, none of the leadership of this country has ever been in combat.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they understand what's involved. The financial cost, too.
Mm-hmm.
They just jumped in. We should have learned that, you know, if you're going to go to war, you better plan it out completely. And a lot of things just weren't planned out at all.
Mm-hmm.
They were too quick to go to war. I'm not quite sure why they were. I mean, because why? The reason they said they wanted to go in initially, of course, has turned out to be false so far.
Mm-hmm.
The American people, for some reason, have forgotten a lot of lessons. It's hard for me to put it into words.
We talked in earlier interviews about your difficulty adjusting back to civilian life, and we went into some detail about that. How do you think the war has most affected your life in general?
It's made me extremely hypervigilant, always aware of aggression. It put into me this sense of accusation by the majority of the American people that we did something immoral. I have had to fight that ever since these confrontations with people and, you know, reading the newspapers and the like.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty well continued. The stereotypical image of so many people of Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
Was one of, you know, we were doing something we shouldn't have done. The pictures of the little girl coming out of the napalm,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, by the way, was dropped by a South Vietnamese aircraft, mm-hmm. not an American aircraft. And, of course, was an accident. And the lack of recognition that the North Vietnamese were exactly what they were pretty well portrayed to be. They're very low on the list of world human rights groups,
mm-hmm.
right now.
Mm-hmm.
They've been for a long time. But the overall generally negative view, it affected a lot of people like me. A lot of other GIs, though, for some reason, it rolled off their backs.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if maybe they just don't talk about it. But, or maybe it's the amount of investment that I put into it,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, makes it seem, you know, I could have been home making money like a lot of people did.
Right.
I have really, really, really fought it. And like I said, when I came home also, I had these problems with, I felt like a fish out of water, and I went to the VA, and, you know, they implied I was sick rather than just an accurate diagnosis of, well, look, you just haven't readjusted. They haven't been back a month.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt uncomfortable sleeping inside a house without knowing that somebody was on guard outside. You know, just
mm-hmm.
that little feeling. It wasn't a major feeling.
Mm-hmm.
But these were things that, you know, that I lived with for over 2 years, and you just don't adjust back from that easy. Other people go through traumatic events,
mm-hmm.
have the same problem, not just in combat.
Mm-hmm.
But I get very angry when I see the stereotypes of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any regrets about serving 3 tours based upon, you know, what's happened to you since Vietnam, that you're 120% disabled and the PTSD and all of that? How do you feel about that?
I guess the major thing that would have me say I wouldn't do it again would be the outcome.
Outcome of the war?
Yeah.
Okay.
Obviously, it was all in vain.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. Considering I come from a military family, considering I was young, that's hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what you would do if you knew the way it was going to come out. If I was in the same situation again, I would have gone, ain't no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm.
The price I've paid since, to me, has been terrible. In looking at that, I guess I'd say I wouldn't do it again. But at the same time, I'm proud that I did try.
Right.
But to go through the number of years that I did where there was very little good help available because the VA had lost, had not picked up,
mm-hmm.
had not learned from experiences from other wars, that was a little hard to take when I realized that,
mm-hmm.
Because they should have.
Has it gotten better? Has the VA become a little bit more adept at handling these issues?
Well, it comes to a point where it's a little bit too late sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
You can alleviate some of the feelings, but at the same time, the older you get, see, these things come out more severely the older you get for mm-hmm. some reason. I'm not quite sure why, but I've heard this about trauma before in all kinds of situations.
Mm-hmm.
That a lot of times it's a delayed reaction. Even though I had been upset when I came back and encountered some of the things that I did, and it bothered me, it didn't bother me as much as it started to 10 years later.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that this change in attitude when they opened the wall and the like, when I marched in that Memorial Day parade,
mm-hmm.
I was really too late, and it didn't make up for everything that had happened. And it was a lot of this, you know, well, we support the troops, but yeah, but what about, do you think we were doing the right thing, and then everybody will hem and haw?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm one that's concerned about, you know, doing the right thing. I always have been all my life.
Mm-hmm.
The last 5 years, it's gotten worse. Living alone has made it even worse, because when you don't have anybody to talk to and the like.
Mm-hmm.
You begin to lose perspective.
You've been in therapy, right?
Several different types.
Okay.
At the same time.
Right. And has that been effective for you? Has it helped?
It's a place where I can talk to some people that understand what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
One of the best therapies has been since I've been able to contact people I was with.
Mm-hmm.
That is definitely been one of the best.
Mm-hmm.
Troops that weren't combat, you don't have the same experience. So I don't think they have the similar feelings because the same kind of investment wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
The fear, the terror, the number of friends killed and the like. But definitely meeting people that I was actually with in the situation again, that camaraderie just doesn't go away. I mean, it's a unifying factor.
What do you think was the most significant thing that you learned about yourself from your three tours?
I learned that I could go farther than I thought I could. Though getting older now, I certainly couldn't go that far these days.
Mm-hmm.
But I learned that I could, well, back then, and for up until the last 5 years, I could adjust to most situations. I learned that I learned things quickly,
mm-hmm.
That I was responsible, I learned more about different people. I had lived in other countries earlier because I was a military dependent.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I learned something about the Asian culture and was more open to it when I arrived than the average person. I learned that war wasn't like on TV, which is a valuable lesson, I feel.
Mm-hmm.
And a more practical sort of experience, knowing what something is actually like. In those situations like that, you know, the political situations, I tend to evaluate things on more of a level of reality. than a lot of people would.
Mm-hmm.
I've learned not to trust the media. And I've learned to don't take offhand what the leadership says. Question authority.
Mm-hmm.
Don't question it just for the sake of questioning it, but think about it and seek out more information.
Mm-hmm.
I have understood what really close relationships, you know, forged under that kind of experience are like. You know, I learned what it's like to actually live down on the ground as people did thousands of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like I said, we'd go out in the jungle and we're out there for months at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Learn little things about nature, how to adjust to it, how to use it. A lot of little positive things that I learned to appreciate, especially the wilderness, the woods.
Go ahead.
And meeting people, again, like in the military, from all walks of life, mm-hmm. Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Is there anything that you would change about your tours there, if you could?
Well, a lot of it would involve the way the military did things.
Mm-hmm.
I would change the way I did a few things, obviously. That seems to be life. If we could do things over again. I thought a lot about the practicality of a few things.
Mm-hmm.
And how things were done. Actually, the longer I was there, the more and the better I learned things, better ways of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
Like I might not have gone to a regular infantry unit on my last tour. I might have tried to go into an advisorial thing to be closer to the Vietnamese. Or possibly long-range reconnaissance, but I don't think I'd take the real, real risky role like SOG.
Mm-hmm.
Those missions there, they were hairy, and I went and picked them up and the like. I don't think I would want to have done that. The flying thing, that had some negatives. I had fear of flying until last June.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there was a lot of excitement and things looked a lot of different in the air. And before I got the fear, you know, it's a different kind of world looking at it from above.
Mm-hmm.
So I would definitely do things a little bit differently. But again, a lot of the things were controlled by unit standard operating procedure, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I could have done some small things to make it a little bit better, for a little bit less risky, or make myself more more valuable to the cause. But a lot of it was out of your control.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any examples of those things that you would have done differently, or ways that you could have made yourself more valuable to the cause?
I would have somehow... Yeah. I think I would have been even more alert. I think I would have tried to learn more about the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
To learn more weapon systems than I did learn, which was quite a few. But I don't know if I would have... I probably would have gone for being a sergeant. I turned that down during all my tours.
Mm-hmm.
But I probably would, if I would do it again, yeah, I probably would have gone for squad leader at least. Hard to say if I would have gone any higher than that. I ended up as a supervisor, of course, in civilian life. And relatively successful at it. Of course, it's a different kind of leadership, but I think I could have made a good sergeant. A lot of it, of course, is based upon an awful lot of reading where I read where different people did different things in different units and the like. So a lot of that was learned after the war and after a lot of thought. But again, you know, certain things you just plain can't do because the standard operator procedure was, no, you don't do this, or yes, you do do that. And, you know, you can end up fighting City Hall. And the military can be a very formidable City Hall. But
you've done some reading on Vietnam.
I've read almost every book that's been out on it.
Are there any that really stick out in your mind as very useful or very well written?
Oh, yeah. I anything that has anything to do with the South Vietnamese and what was going on, you know, in their army, and I learned quite a bit there that, that kind of backed up what I saw, you know, that they were gradually improving. That when you read more in detail about how the French left their army, left the Vietnamese army, South Vietnamese army, and you get to understand also that you don't build an army overnight. There was a fantastic book that came out last year, the year before, the 25-year war, or the, it was written by a South Vietnamese general. 25-year century, I don't know what it was. He shows, you know, how you have to build up an army. And our in our army, and it's always been this way, in order to make, let's say, a staff command, where you're making a lot of the major decisions and the like, you basically have to have a minimum, a bare minimum, of a four-year degree. And then the equivalent of graduate degrees. You have to get an awful lot of education. And, of course, you can't do that overnight. And the South, and we were helping South Vietnamese set that up. And it started to show later on in the war, but unfortunately, that's when we started to pull out. So that's incredibly valuable. Anything about the South Vietnamese themselves, I like to see their point of view. And they're more understandable when you listen to their point of view. I have read books by North Vietnamese and the like. Most of them by North Vietnamese who were disillusioned and left the communist cause either during or after the war. It's interesting to see how they were just as human and had their difficult bureaucracies and bad leaders and good leaders and, you know, strengths and weaknesses. Learned an awful lot about how the support units functioned even better than what I learned there, because, you know, I could see the result, but I didn't know how it came about necessarily. And the different services, the different jobs, mainly combat jobs. There aren't too many books out by people who weren't combat. There are some books out that were that are just plain bullshit war stories. Guys that were in Vietnam but just over elaborated to the point of ridiculousness. And if you'd been there, you'd know. I mean, every stereotypical little thing you've heard about the Vietnam War happened to them. And you know that, no, no way. And I've heard statements that, you know, about places I've been, and they describe how it looked and how it was set up and what happened there. And I know that ain't true. In fact, one of them is called And the Hard Rain Fell. That book is, that is a horrible, horrible, horrible book.
By John Ketwick.
Is that the name of the person?
Mm-hmm.
Nice name for the book, unfortunately. And he was in Vietnam. He describes the Battle of Dak Tho, and you know, it was just, and again, every stereotypical thing possible happened.
Mm-hmm.
He was a truck driver. They show on the front cover as an infantryman, but you know, he talks about he was a truck driver.
Mm-hmm.
At least he admitted to that. But that is such a disgusting book. But then there's all the books on the negative aspects, and I've tried to read them, got halfway through, and you know, seen it's just based on idealism or somebody who wasn't there and who's writing on the stereotypical picture of Vietnam, and who went into the whole thing just looking for the negatives. And of course, if you look for the negatives or you look for just the positives, then that's what you're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
I do prefer to read a book where both the negatives and the positives are discussed.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, every situation has negatives and positives to it. I have read books where I just finished one where it's a reprint of another book where man ended up truly admiring the North Vietnamese as fighting soldiers, which I do too. Unfortunately, they were misled. They were very, very good troops. Just as tough as the Japanese. Very, very resilient. Had a lot of help from the news media, of course.
Mm-hmm.
A tremendous amount of help. But they were very tough troops, and we did admire them. We may have said negative things about them, but as I told you earlier, that was based on fear, and you do this to bring down your enemy in your mind and build yourself up.
Mm-hmm.
But I've read almost every book. I really have.
What do you think about Vietnam today?
I wouldn't want to live there. South Vietnam seems to be a more vibrant area than North Vietnam. They have the Constitution. They claim they have an awful lot of freedoms, but they're not necessarily carried through. I've talked to so many. I've had South Vietnamese working for me. I've also read the human rights reports. Again, reading the books on South Vietnamese that talk about after the war, and they all jive completely.
Mm-hmm.
They all match each other. And from what I know of the North Vietnamese leadership, yes, that's definitely them. It's to me, it's a real shame that they don't have some of the freedoms that they have, that you can go to jail for so long for, just making public statements against communism or
mm-hmm.
against the government. It's incredible, 20 years. Crimes against the state. I love that one.
Mm-hmm.
20, 30 years, it's just you're convicted of crimes against the state. And that's a beautifully vague statement. And it says an awful lot. And I would really, I see a lot of our influence still in South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody I've talked to that's been back to Vietnam has said in the South they're received very positively. In the North, not as positively.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of curiosity factor.
Sure. Would you want to go back?
Boy, have I debated that, I'll tell you. I do and I don't.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the places I'd like, I wouldn't want to go back on a set tour.
Mm-hmm.
I also know, well, most of the guys that have been back have told me that when they went on a set tour, the tour guide would really accentuate a lot of the negative, go out of their way to point out old rust and destroyed American equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And not come out and say you were bad people, okay, directly, but more of a lot of insinuation and trying to point out suffering caused by Americans rather than the suffering that was caused by the enemy. But there are some private tours that you can take. You still have to have certain government officials, I guess, or sponsors go with you, which tells me a lot. And a lot of the places I'd like to go back to, I could find some of them I couldn't ever find again. And I wouldn't be able to make the trek physically, let's say up to the top of Hill 875 or whatever. It's just, it's still way out in the middle of nowhere. I would probably be very upset to see former South Vietnamese soldiers, South Vietnamese soldier cemeteries, things like that. I would feel guilty around the South Vietnamese people for what my country did to them and the betrayal. And I would probably feel resentful in North Vietnam. In a couple of ways, there's a couple of North Vietnamese, if they were still alive, I'd like to meet. I believe I talked about where a North Vietnamese walked into our ambush, and I fired off six rounds at, you know, very, what is it, 8 feet, something like that. And yes, I missed them, but I'd like to meet them and say, you know, number one, did I hit you? Number two, I'm glad at this point that I didn't kill you, you know. But I'd like to go back to some of the places, like Phu Lạc, the Thuy Hoa area. Again, it, with the exception of my third tour, most of my time was spent out in the mountains and the jungle. My third tour was spent around Phu Lạc, and I would like to see Phu Lạc again. I would like to go to some up the Bac Ma behind it and see what was up there. I could only see from down low, see the old French ruins of the French villas along the cusp of the mountaintop. You know, those kind of things. But I would want to go on a tour that I could tailor to my needs. I'm not interested in seeing some places that had absolutely nothing to do with me. I'm not interested in being dragged to My Lai. So like I say, and I'd like to set it up myself, but at the same time, I have those negative feelings that I expressed about it. So,
have you ever been to the wall in Washington?
No, and I've resisted it. I was just offered by a friend to have the cost paid, and I turned it down for two reasons. I have an uncomfortability with it, and some pride over somebody else paying for it. I've seen the traveling wall once, but I don't know. I just have a, I'm not sure why, but a resistance, an emotional resistance going. I think it may symbolize that I consider myself almost killed in action emotionally. I mean, I miss the guys that that I did know that were killed, you know, so many of them. But I think there's something personal in it, and I tend to avoid it. I was in D.C. 2 years ago, or a year and a half ago, at a reunion with C Company, 227th Assault Helicopter Battalion, and on the last day they were going down to the wall, and I opted out. I left and drove back to my sister's. She lives about 30 miles away in West Virginia.
Do you think you'll ever go?
I don't know. I don't want to go and see. I've seen pictures of these guys that have been in Vietnam, and they got all their patches and medals, and, you know, the crying bit and everything, and I guess I'm not, I don't let my emotions out like that, and I wouldn't go so ostentatiously with all these patches and medals and stuff like that. I might have a hat on that might say something about Vietnam, just Vietnam or whatever, Vietnam veteran, but that's all. I've always been rather prefer to be a lot more low-keyed about it. I have a Vietnam campaign sticker on the back of my truck. And the only people that know what it is other Vietnam veterans, usually.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these in-your-face kind of stickers that used to be around, I always avoided them. I don't hate Jane Fonda anymore. You know, so those kind of I see some people still have, some veterans still have those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. To me, it's almost, I sometimes I wonder about them, you know, how many were actually in combat. I just don't like to stand out like that and overlook it. And I'm definitely not one to stand in public and cry over it.
Right. Well, if you had the opportunity to talk to young people today about Vietnam, the younger generations, what would you tell them about the war?
I tell them that what they hear mainly, what they know mainly about it is not the truth. That the press was very biased. That the only thing that we did wrong morally was to abandon the enemy. I mean, the South Vietnamese, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
And militarily we didn't lose that war. And that the South Vietnamese, for the most part, did not want the communists in.
Mm-hmm.
I would also point out no micromanagement. Of course, that was a major issue during the war.
Mm-hmm.
People who didn't know military strategy and the like and just dealt through a political point of view were making decisions that should have been made by military people.
Mm-hmm.
That a lot of our mistakes, some were mistakes, others were really foolish mistakes, like saying that we weren't bombing Cambodia and Laos, and we should have just come out and said, yeah, we are bombing North Vietnamese in Cambodia and Laos. We're not bombing Cambodians.
Mm-hmm.
And if the North Vietnamese want to go off and just keep up this charade that they didn't have any troops in Cambodia and Laos, you know, let them. But I generally tell the press, you know, well, hey, you know where the border is. We'll drive you there.
Mm-hmm.
Go in, come out, and make a report. Also, plan everything. When we went in there, you know, initially, it was mainly just troops that would help in the war and the like on a combat basis. But I noticed long about 68, my God, the base camps were building huge ice houses, and you know, it was. There were six men in the rear for every one man in combat,
mm-hmm.
which is too much. It made it look, I don't know. I'm sure it made to some South Vietnamese made it look like a permanent establishment, whereas it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of money was spent on keeping the troops, keeping the morale up, but of course that didn't extend to troops in the field. That mainly helped troops in the rear. We should have gone into Cambodia and Laos, wherever your enemy is. I mean, that's where you have to go get them. You've got to fight to win. You can't fight to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And I would point out that you don't go into a war unless you are really prepared for it. Trying to say it without making some relationship to what's going on now, which, you know, I completely disagree with in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Let the generals fight the war. It's like if you have an expert in a certain field, again, the micromanagement thing,
mm-hmm.
The generals really did want to fight it in one way, and politicians wouldn't let them. It was very frustrating for the man in the field to know that your enemy had a sanctuary and he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably would have pointed out that being a small unit war, we should have used more small units. There should have been more reconnaissance kind of thing, mainly on finding the enemy, rather than sweeping with large units against small enemy units. Only use large units to sweep against large units, or use large units to destroy the enemy when you find them.
But again,
that sometimes you do have to fight. Don't get and go into this negotiating thing with people that are not in all good faith negotiating, and you've got to realize that as soon as possible if they're not, and then just break off negotiating until they have a good reason to negotiate seriously. That was such a complete farce right there. But mainly that what they hear and the stereotypes that they hear are not what was happening. We were not brutal troops. We were not a bunch of Nazi stormtroopers. But there always are some people who will break the law in civilian life and in military situations. And that still South Vietnam is a much more lively place, vibrant place than North Vietnam. And I think that's one of our legacies there. And someday we may win just through the economic concept that we left behind. And I think we also left behind a concept of democracy that's much less alien to a South Vietnamese than to a North Vietnamese. But that may be a long time down the road. The North Vietnamese have realized that, you know, capitalism is a better system, though they don't want to go too far. They're very cautious of it because to have proper capitalism, you have to have more freedom for people, more independent thinking, and dictatorships, of course, do not like independent thinking. I would also emphasize, you know, what the North Vietnamese actually were and what they did to the South after the war. Along that line.
Okay.
I would have to fight very hard not to show my bitterness and not to overly concentrate on what I feel was accusations of immorality. I'd have to fight that very hard because to me that has been so important for 30 years.
Andy, is there anything else that you want to add or talk about that we have not covered in our interview sessions?
Offhand right now, I can't say. I get to thinking about all these things, you know. Vietnam is generally something that I feel unfortunate to me. I think about it too often. I should let it go somehow, but I can't. I know I'm not alone. But I believe it's one of the more disgraceful, how we ended the war. It's one of the more noble things we did, one of the more noble things we did going into it, but how we ended it was one of the more ignoble things that we did to cut and run. That's pretty much my feelings. I mean, it's the experiences that happened to me, the feelings I have now about the whole thing, the, you know, what it did to me, what it did to a lot of other guys. I some lessons were learned. The micromanagement thing seems to have been overcome, but some other lessons weren't. They still don't plan enough before they really get into these things. I guess it could have come out worse. It definitely could have come out better. If I was in the same situation as I was in 1966, I probably would have done the same thing I did. That was volunteered and gone to Vietnam.
All right. Well, we'll go ahead and end the oral history interview with Mr. Antoine Roy. Sir, thank you very much for all of your time.
All right.